A bit warm today, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Did you know what I had to do in New Zealand? You know what they forced me to do?
No.
It was really awful. Let's see. This is in Queenstown, you know, at the Southern Alps. And they pushed me off a mountain.
Oh, really? My God.
Oh, it was horrible. You can see me there. I'm just hanging on for
your joy.
You look so...
Is it a bungee jump?
Wow. No,
it's
no.
It's just parachuting. Looks like
paragliding.
Paragliding. Wow. Oh, how wonderful.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just spent like a whole week talking about, you know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And I kept, and everybody was asking questions, well, exactly what is compassion? And I'm saying, well, you know, really, the Vasudhi Magga says that when you understand compassion, there is the experience of spaciousness. So then I get on this, you know.
Why don't I just shut up and make everybody go paragliding?
That's so great. And he has this string with a stick with a camera.
Oh,
and he pulls the string, gets the stick, and he hits the button, and he says, so you're there, you're like, just listen out, just, you know. And we kept catching thermals, we kept going up and up. Usually it takes 10 minutes, he said, from the time you jump off the mountain until you land. We were up for 40 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So we just kept catching thermals and catching them. You're looking way down at seagulls, you know, about this big, way out there. It's so beautiful. And he keeps saying, look at the camera. And I'm going, yeah, okay. So one of those pictures that is a really classic expression on my face, because he says, look at the camera one more time. And I go, I don't want to look at the camera. Click. This is what you're forced to do if you have friends in New Zealand. Sad, but there you go. So, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo, I name Tassa, the state, Bhagavato of blessedness, Arahato, where the outer and the inner are the same. The great victor, breaker of the spokes that push the wheel of, you know, how sometimes you feel like maybe you're doing something that you did before 5,000 times. Have I had this love affair before? Have I done this with a friend before? You know, that breaker of the spokes that makes the wheel keep turning you around and around. Sama, complete, total, holy, Sambuddhassa, with that state of blessing, with that state of discovery. I name the state of awakening. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Sadhu. So thank you for turning up again. And, we covered a few little things last night about why Buddhism may be relevant. Do you remember what we covered last night? What do you remember from last night?
We talked about the Dhyani Buddhas.
Yeah, I know. Yes, we did. What else? Wasn't very interesting. See, you can tell.
Well, we talked about the Dhyani Buddhas in terms of the hindrances and powers of... Since those things that plague us won't go away, how do you then use them to some extent to move it into new territories?
And what about arising yoga? Did we talk about arising yoga at all?
We're an
inner tube. Yeah, we talked about being an inner tube.
Yes.
Because there's an opening here, and you know there's another opening somewhere in your body. And this tube that goes right down you, right? So it's all this flesh around this space, right? So we're an inner tube, really. Right?
That's great.
And we're mostly space. And but we keep feeling like we're solid. Right? Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. And do you remember the wheel? Mm-hmm. How many of you remember the wheel? Remember sometimes you look at a wheel, a picture of a wheel, or a movie of a wheel, and the spokes look like it's going backward? Do you remember that? Ever anyone ever seen that when you looked at a movie? And no, you haven't? You see a motorcycle, but if you look at the spokes, it looks like the wheel's going backward. Some of you have seen that. Have you ever seen that in a movie? Why does it look like that?
I don't know.
It's curious, though, isn't it?
It's strange.
Because you can see the vehicle going forward, but the wheel seems to be going back.
I don't know.
Because it takes a picture. So here's the spoke right here. Here's one spoke here. And when this spoke is almost all around to the beginning again, it takes a picture just before it gets to the beginning. And then when it's almost around to the beginning again, so that here it was where it started. This is the first picture. Second picture is there. Third picture is there. So the pictures show when the spoke hasn't quite got the full distance. So it looks like it's going backward. And then I talked about how your brain does that. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
You do, because that's the point I want to make.
I hope you remember that one.
Because all of the time that you think you're seeing something, what you're seeing is a picture that your mind takes, and then there is a long gap, and then a picture that your mind takes, and you fill in the space between the pictures with whatever is meaningful to you at that time, or habitual. Did you know you do that? So there's this very interesting thing that is called perception. Perception is based on who's looking. So, for example, you get things like this. Don't you think that's funny? I think that's hilarious. Can't see it? What? Is that good?
Very good.
It's like, you know, what you're looking at is dependent totally on who's looking. Mm-hmm. Isn't that brilliant? Mm-hmm. I love a t-shirt of that, actually. Imagine walking down the street with that one. Or sometimes perception is like this. Do you know the magazine Buddhadharma?
Yes.
You know that picture?
Yeah.
Sometimes perception is like that, isn't it? You know, when you're in a good mood, somebody that you're sort of neutral about is quite nice.
Yes.
And well, that's quite curious, isn't it? You know, every time I do a retreat, people are so much nicer when I come out. It's just amazing. They get so nice. They're so kind and considerate. They laugh at all my jokes, you know. It's really wonderful. Then when I haven't done a retreat for a while, you know, they're kind of a little dull. You know, they don't get my jokes. Like, you know, it's sort of irritable. They're irritable. What can I say? I don't know. They forget what I want. Do you ever have any of those experiences?
Yes.
Some days you wake up and you just know you don't want to see anybody. Any of you ever feel that way?
Yes.
And if you do see somebody, you're not particularly happy to see them. Mm-hmm. And whatever they say, you can sort of remember for the next time. You can collect that evidence and have a little scrapbook for in case you don't have enough evidence against them, should you want to be pissed off at them at any time. Can't you do that? So that's basically what is called arising yoga. Arising yoga in the Tibetan Buddhist system. And you remember that quote now from Lama Yeshe?
Yes.
which was what? Basically saying that in what you do with these figures is that you imagine yourself becoming a radiant, joyful, compassionate being. And then he said, actually, this is not different from what you're already doing, only now, instead of projecting yourself as your usual self-pitying, miserable being, you're projecting yourself as a radiant being and moving around with a state of divine pride. So it's actually rather than, because all of these kinds of perceptions that we have, they are all so automatic and they are all so powerful that half the time when somebody says something that we've decided we don't like, we're already angry. We're not watching the anger and deciding whether we want to be angry. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We have no control over who's home. Like all these different characters, half of whom we wouldn't like if we met, keep moving in, don't they? She's vibrating. And here we are, just minding our own business, supposedly. And then suddenly we find ourselves driven by this idea or that fear or that hope. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
And then later, maybe we say, oh, I should have said this, or, oh, gee, I'm sorry I said that, you know. Oh, I wish I hadn't told them I'd meet them for coffee. I don't want to go out, you know, whatever it is, right?
Yes.
Because we don't know that you actually have a choice. You actually have a choice. You can watch the fear. You can watch the anger. You are actually like this, only bigger. You are as big as the sky. Your mind is as big as the sky. You can actually watch the different states come and go and decide how you want to use them.
Mm-hmm.
That's called arising yoga. You can't do anything about what others are doing. You can do everything about how you're reacting to it. You can't do anything about whether you're in a fatal accident. You can do everything about how you're reacting to it. You can't do anything about the people you love having difficulty or pain. You can do everything about how you react to it. There is no safety. Damn! Well, damn, I bought insurance! But there is no safety. Other than Trig, and I'm going to come back before, and I'd like to know where he is. I don't know anybody who's going to live forever. I've got to get your address that you're going to go to after this for the next three, so I can check it out. I believe if anybody could.
Sure.
Because the physical realm is continuously dissolving. Countries dissolve, new countries come into being, language changes every 10 years, even every 6 months. If you have done a 6-month retreat or even a 3-month retreat sometimes, and you come out of retreat and people are using words that you don't know what they mean. Because you weren't there when that newscast happened, mm-hmm. or that record came out, or that politician eloped with his, you know, whatever. And there, these languages going that everybody knows really, really well. Because everybody is continuously fed into the changes, so it always seems, you know, every day you get told what you are becoming that day. Mm. Every day you're told what you're becoming, and some people start to try to catch up with that.
Mm.
Try to accomplish something. What are you going to accomplish? This is it. So how are you going to use it? That's where Buddhism goes.
Mm.
That's where Buddhism goes. I'm sorry, because so many of us are really addicted to the idea that we can trade ourselves in on a better model. Mm. Well, it's true, isn't it? But the thing is you know what? There isn't a better model. You are exquisitely perfect. Every aspect of your being is exactly what it should be. But how you're using it, now you come to a different quality. Now you come to a different quality. Are you willing to consider that maybe there could be something about you that's a little more divine than you have thought? Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? This was in a newspaper in Totnes when I was in England in November last year. And the editorial page, and there's no name on it. But I've been carting it around ever since.
It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. It is brilliant.
It is.
There are some people, they look at it, they get angry. One or two, not that many. Most people, there's a little gasp. And the one in the Buddha Dharma too, with the hand puppet, you know, with the monster on it. It's very specific. Do you have a question? No. Yes.
You read something last night. Well, first of all, I had a whole range of interesting dreams last night.
Oh, goody.
From what you were saying during the evening, lots of metaphors and images kept coming up. But nothing that really came into a clear linear question. But you read something which struck me a lot. I can't remember it very much, except the feeling of it. It was it finished with the metaphor of desires and the sea.
Last night I read that? I thought I just read that one thing last night, didn't I?
Maybe it was the one thing. Yeah. It was fairly short.
Was the quote I just read?
It's a quote.
That with the picture of Amitabha on it in the calendar? Lama Yeshe?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, but there wasn't anything about the sea in that. But what I was thinking about reading today has something about the sea. Are you sure you're not being pasik?
I'm not sure.
Casting your mind into the future?
It's not a common habit of mine.
It can happen any time, though. I don't remember reading that. Does anyone else?
What was that?
We're talking about mirror-like wisdom and the sea in the sky.
I talked about mirror-like wisdom, but I didn't read anything. I talked about how the wisdom of Akshobhya is called mirror-like wisdom, the blue one. Mm-hmm. And that the mirror is absolutely clear and can reflect anything and rejects nothing and is never polluted or marred by what it reflects and is as huge as the sky, can never fill it up, and its consciousness. Is that what you're thinking? I read that. I mean, those are all descriptions that I've been taught or I've read, but I just plucked it out of my gray matter.
You actually read before you began on the five, I forget the name.
Dhyani Buddhas.
I believe the only thing I read last night was a quote from Lama Yeshe.
I think it was it.
Yeah. Which I didn't bring tonight. Nope. I didn't. So, anything more you want to add?
Not just now, I think.
Okay. So in terms of the relevance of Buddhism, and in particularly the Buddhist path of visualizing oneself as empty and then evoking the energy of compassion and then imagining a figure that is the manifestation of compassion in a radiant form and then becoming one with it. To do that practice actually starts your mind having more choices about how you react. Mm. It actually does that. Mm. You actually are now performing an arising yoga that you learned from watching your parents, watching the people around you, because we first learn how to react to circumstances by the emotional body. Mm-hmm. Don't we? Mm. Don't you think so?
Yeah.
If your father or your mother or the people around you were happy, it was easier to be happy.
Yes.
If they were worried, it was easier to be worried. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
And the emotional body is the same body as that body that is the winds or the energies. So if you practice having a different emotional body, it's like you're opening the door of the wardrobe a little further. And not just picking out your usual mental wardrobe. You're not just taking the t-shirts you usually wear from the front. You're reaching back and maybe taking some nice tutu for a change, or a 4-4 or a 6-6. Something with a little pizzazz to it, you know. Something of quiet yet dignified elegance. Because those are all part of our emotional wardrobe, but we tend to just keep going for the same ones. When you look in the mirror, do you always have the same reaction to yourself? Are you sure? And when you're just doing it every morning? Just every morning, not when you're dressed up? Are you sure? You don't just when you get up in the morning, you're going to brush your teeth, isn't there?
Oh, it's her again.
Are you sure? What is it that you, what is, how do you, there is a sort of a, if you watch, like watch, maybe you don't, maybe that's quite entirely possible, I'm just curious about that, but you watch that usually when you see yourself first in the morning, there's already a sense of who you're looking at.
Mm.
And then a second later you see yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
A second later, you check for pimples or whatever.
That first glance.
First glance is, oh yeah, it's you again.
So
who is that? You know, that's a habitual arising yoga already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, imagine thinking you're about to see Chenrezig just before you look.
Wow.
That would be a very nice way to make Buddhism relevant. Right. In your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
It's your habitual view of yourself. Just slip somebody else in there every once in a while. Just for the heaven of it. Or if you want. You can do it for the hell of it, too.
Or not.
This is good.
This is good?
It's like, well, because last year we were talking about perception and shifting, and I'm getting it, like, and hearing it. It's like, you know, when you're talking about looking, it's like you look and you expect to see.
That's right.
You have an expectation to see a certain thing, but then if you really stop and look, you're not going to see it.
You're not seeing that at all.
And if you actually, you know,
change the emotion of who's looking.
Yeah.
What it is that's looked at is different.
It's a different
because if you change the passion, you change the perception. Yeah. If you change the perception, you change the passion.
Yeah.
We have a habitual way of being in the world. It's arising yoga. It is deity yoga. You are holding your energy in a way that is safe, dependent on all the causes and effects that formed you. So you fit into certain circumstances this way and not into other ones that way. There are things you like and things you don't like because they affirm that speech body. If you start imagining yourself as a different character, your relationship with the whole world around you will change.
What a discipline it is, though. What a discipline that is, though.
Why would you want to assume that arising yoga? See?
Yeah.
Do you understand that? Yeah. It's like really specific. It's like maybe then try another arising yoga.
Right.
What a joy.
Right.
It's an infinite wardrobe.
Right.
We're going to play dress up. Pass me that pink boa now. I love them long pink feathers. Sequins, please. For my eyebrows. And again, like we have like habitual reactions to things. So the exercise that you've heard from me forever is so useful for this. When you see something you like, find something you dislike in it. When you see something you dislike, find something you like in it. If you're at a stop sign and somebody's crossing the street and you really like their shoes, find something you dislike in them. Mm-hmm. They're not yours. Whatever. Doesn't matter. If you see shoes that you just can't stand, find something you like in it. They're not yours. Whatever.
Why is it good to find something that you dislike about things you like?
So that you don't get caught in only repeating the same patterns, so that you have some new understandings. So that your life becomes more creative, more joyful. So that you're not caught in despair if you don't have what you like.
It's basically a recipe for non-attachment?
It is basically a recipe for non-attachment. But a particular type of non-attachment, a non-attachment where you can still like and dislike, but you're not depending on getting what you like or dislike. We cannot be guaranteed that we're always going to get what we like or get what we dislike. But what we can do is have a choice. If I dislike something and I get it, I don't have to be caught in dislike.
I like music, for instance, or visual art. I can go to a gallery and really enjoy looking at that picture. I don't have to have it. I'm not attached to it, but why would I look for something I dislike about that feeling?
You wouldn't necessarily. I'm saying small things. Small things. Not something, I mean, not the Da Vinci exhibit. No.
But, so where's the...
But, do you like coffee?
Yes.
Do you drink coffee late at night?
No.
So you don't like drinking it late at night.
Yes.
So you can say, oh, good, a good coffee. Oh, I certainly couldn't drink this. I wouldn't like to drink this when it was 10 o'clock. Just to practice bringing in some flexibility of the mind. Perhaps you don't need to do this exercise. But for many people, they feel very upset if they don't get what they like. Or if they like something and then it gets a dent in it.
Mm.
If they buy a really exquisite CD, I don't know, of whom singing. Cecilia. Cecilia Bartoli singing. Yes! Magnificent arias, like we didn't listen to in the car yet. Mm-hmm. I brought a CD of Cecilia Bartoli to listen to in the car, and we haven't listened to it yet. So I'm thinking about it. Say, do you like Cecilia Bartoli? Yeah, like, she can sing. And then it's got a scratch on it. How am I going to feel? Am I going to be upset about that? I know people that would just ruin. It would ruin their drive. They would just. Do you know people who would really hurt?
Sure.
But how upsetting that a scratch in a CD can create the inability to see the beauty of what is present.
Mm-hmm. But you're suggesting that when I see the beauty of what is present, I will look for something negative in it.
Not every time. I said as an exercise, once in a while, that one exercises the mind to not depend on only getting what is like. And I'm certainly not saying, you know, when you love your daughter, find something you dislike in her, or like, you know, things that are truly the heart. But little practices. Just little ones. And you don't actually, you know, put a dead fly in your soup. You just imagine if there was one. And then you say, oh, but there isn't. And but you just see how you can play your mind. It's really teaching us how to have the power to, when we have a reaction to something, to have the choice to see whether maybe we don't want to use the reaction that way. So maybe you already do that, I don't know. But for a lot of people, they are caught by their reactions, they're caught by habitual anger, caught by habitual greed. So to actually be able to practice knowing that you are not your greed, you are not your anger. Those are things that come and go. So that you actually begin to, first of all, you have to realize, from a Buddhist point of view, in this book, for example, in Lamdre, is talking about the three stages of training that are part of the highest yoga tantra teaching of the Sakya tradition, and it's called the three visions. First is called the impure vision. The impure vision is when you actually believe what you see. Because you're not aware that your eyes are taking pictures and your mind is making the meaning based on habituation. You're not aware that you're always at a movie. And most of us are like that most of the time, aren't we? And we get very busy in our movie, don't we? Mm-hmm. Starring me, directed by me, written, edited, casting, minor players, not really. So, that's called the impure vision, because you're subject to whatever occurs. When everything is so habitual, you're like Pavlov's dog. When this happens, you feel this way, and this happens, you feel this way. When joy comes, you are elated. When pain comes, you are depressed. You remember that teaching by, what's his name? Remember it? What's his name? You know his name, don't you? Oh, you know his name? You don't remember? Sakyamuni, don't you remember? Sakyamuni Buddha?
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, the eight worldly dharmas, the four worldly ideals, you remember that? I gave it to you.
She did.
In print. I read it to you. How many times have I read that to you?
Many.
Many times. Gain and loss, fame and notoriety,
obscurity,
praise and blame,
having and not having.
Yeah. happiness and unhappiness. They're called the eight worldly dharmas.
Yes.
And when you get something, you're elated, and when you don't get it, you're depressed. Mm-hmm. When somebody loves you, you're elated. When you don't love, you're depressed. When somebody criticizes you, you're depressed. When somebody admires you, you're elated. When you're in control and you're the queen of the universe or king or whatever, yes, things are as they should be. And when you're totally obscured and like feel powerless, you're... Is that true?
Yes.
So that's called the impure vision, where your sense of yourself depends totally on outer objects. How can I be compassionate if I cannot separate myself from somebody else's bad mood? Mm-hmm. If somebody else is suffering from a toothache and their dog mistook them for the postman and bit them when they were on their way downstairs to go to the bathroom and they peed on the floor, on the stairs, and slipped down the stairs and banged their head, they might not be in the best of the mood if I just have to be ringing the doorbell to hand them a ticket they bought, you know, 10 years ago and I just remembered to deliver it to them, you know. I mean, they might be in a bad mood. And if my whole world crashes because I say, what are you doing here? Whose problem is that? They have their problem, and now I am making myself a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking, oh, that person is really caught up in some pain. Mm-hmm. All money came home. Am I?
No.
No, I'm like, oh, how I have suffered. Oh, life is just so, they misunderstood me again.
Frankly, my dear.
I give many damn. So that is called impure vision. And if you watch in your life how much of the time I watch my life, how much of the time I am busy because I am becoming based on impure vision. Mm-hmm. It is very hard to practice Dharma because so much of myself doesn't want to. Mm-hmm. So much of this conditioned being is so addicted to becoming, just likes to be that rat in the cage running because I'm about to get a prize, about to get something. Isn't that the feeling?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm about to get something. So long as I'm doing that, when do I stop and see, well, I wonder what I've got? Or how could I use what I've got? I'll tell you, quite frankly, there are very few people that I meet that actually really want to practice Dharma. I look in the mirror, and very rarely do I meet someone there who really wants to practice Dharma. Because it's very hard for us to unhook ourselves.
Yes.
From thinking that in the next minute I'm going to meditate, in the next minute I'm going to practice kindness. Well, I just stubbed my toe. Wait a minute, I have to rub it first. And so therefore we need each other to keep reminding each other. There is no other way.
Yes.
There is no other way. But I am such a slouch, and you? Well, okay, some of you are better than me. Yeah?
Is this why it's called the excellent sign?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. because with all of us together, at some point or other, there's going to be at least one of us who's going to be manifesting that, so we can all maybe catch it.
Yeah.
That's why Sangha is a refuge. That's why we need each other.
Isn't that about to get?
It is not trying to get something in the future, it's trying to be present. To receive, not to grab. Does that make it, is there a difference in those two to you?
Yes.
It can seem like it, and very often I have been meditating, grabbing like mad. And then every once in a while I fall into just receiving.
I just don't know how to be totally honest with yourself in the sense that I'm really preparing myself for receiving and not preparing myself for grabbing.
I don't think, my friend, it has a lot to do with an experience of honesty so much as an experience of discovery. Even just having the question of what is the difference between the two will bring interest into the picture. And if there is interest, that state will arise. Because the key to being present is to be interested.
Yes.
It's through interest that it happens. That's why we do aspiration, to evoke the interest in just seeing, who am I when I'm not trying for anything. And you know you've had that experience already. You know that when you're looking at art, that your sense of past and future just disappears for a moment. And there is just openness.
That's with all beautiful feelings. With
yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. With all of us. All of us. So I'm saying you do know that experience. And so how to dwell in that experience all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So then when one would be interested in that, then it's, you know that when that happens, you're not trying for it, you just open, and there it is.
And you're getting attached to that?
It's always there. That feeling is always there. That opening is always there. We put coats of becoming on top of it. So it's not so much a matter of anything but letting go of and practicing being interested in the present. I'm not sure that actually communicated to you very well. Was I all right?
I'm not sure that I really truly distinguish that difference. Like as you said, you know, the question is always there, and the awareness of the question, of the ambiguity of the situation, potential ambiguity at least, is there. But I'm not sure that I can distinguish the difference between the...
I didn't actually say the question is always there. I said the state is always there. That state, because you use that example, I will use it with you because then I know that you understand me. When you are looking at a beautiful object or hearing beautiful music, there isn't particularly a sense of time, is there? Is there?
No.
Or even a particularly a sense of yourself. Is there? The sense of the self kind of disappears, doesn't it? There's just this opening. Would you say that would be a good description?
Yes, probably.
Okay. When you're trying to get somewhere because you're 10 minutes late, is there a sense of yourself? Very strong. And in relation to everything around you, all the light's going to change. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so continuously reinforced by one's projections on everything around one. And so it's a very closed, populated world. Is that true? The difference between those two is what I'm talking about. I am saying categorically that first state where one is standing in the state of beauty of, and there is no sense of self, is the natural state of mind. That's how we're born. Well, there's a few little glitches, but more or less that's how we're born. That is more natural when we're very small. And then over time we start developing subject-object relating. So by the time we're four, we can differentiate quite clearly between me and you. Before that, it's iffy, but by the time we're four, I know that if I say I didn't look in the box, you won't know that I didn't unless you were in the room. So I know that your experience and my experience are two different experiences. And so then there starts to be a me in relation to you stronger and stronger, and then comes the social learning and the social skills, right? So that by the time we're 10, 20, 30, 40, it is so habitual, we have to almost be tricked into watching a hot air balloon in the sky. Don't we? Almost. Or a crow stretch their wing. But the things that we allow to be our passion and our beauty, they can always open us. So then what I'm talking about is that state is always there, but we layer it with busyness and with becoming. Subject-object duality. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Excuse me. It's like the process, it can get scary because you're kind of unraveling to begin to open to that sense.
Oh, it's very scary.
And
it's very scary.
It's like...
Because we have good reason for every one of our attitudes and defenses. We've learned them.
It's our survival pattern.
So having the excellent Sangha, others, to remind us
right.
that they still see us even though we're unraveling. You know what I'm saying? There is
oh, yeah.
someone to recognize, you know, so it's not like total abandonment. It's not like total... Do you know?
Oh, yeah, we need each other very much.
You know what I'm saying? And yes. and to then, like, to get to a point of saying, yeah, I need that Sangha, like, getting tired of doing it all myself, you know, being the independent type of having survived alone and, you know, to open up to there.
Wanting a bigger wardrobe rather than I'll do
yeah,
it all
like
myself.
Yeah, to do that, it can be a challenge, like, it can... But it's a good thing because it, you know, but it's...
Everything is a challenge.
Yeah.
None
yeah.
of us want to do this work.
Yeah. So...
All of us are totally dedicated to the idea that even though it's never worked before, if I just go at this brick wall in the right angle, I'm sure it will suddenly part and I'll get to the other side. Because I know there's a room on the other side of this wall. I know that there's space on the other side. I know I saw the garage, and I know if I can just figure out how to approach this wall right, it will open and I'll be able to get through. So we keep trying and trying and trying, you know, and we paint the wall, we paint a door on it, and then we paint a door off it, and we, you know, put a stereo there and try to go through the music, and, you know. We have 1,001 things, and we just, like, keep trying and trying and trying, and to actually walk away from that feels like we are abandoning something that might be right. We might be about to get it. We might be about to get it. It's just so close. That's the feeling. And who would I be if I didn't just try it once more? Is that clear?
Huh?
those two things, and they are so painful. So therefore, it's very specific in the teaching of Buddhism. First, you meditate on the preciousness of a human birth. That is to say, you meditate on what is precious about where you are, not about what you're about to get. And whenever you find yourself not sure about your ground, that's what you do. You meditate on the precious human birth. Every time you meditate on the precious human birth, it opens your ground and it supports you better. Every time I do a retreat, I meditate on the precious human birth. I've done more than one retreat, you know, over the years. And every time I do it, it's a new meditation. Mm-hmm. And why do you do that? You meditate on the precious human birth so that you actually begin to be more interested in your precious moment than in what you think might work. Mm. And then what do you meditate on? You meditate on impermanence. Then you realize, and guess what? It's like a candle. Mm. And it could go out. Mm. Stephen Levine's book, 1 Year to Live. It's beautiful for that. Just beautiful for that. Is that what it's called, 1 Year to Live, or The Last Year, or something like that? Do you know Stephen Levine? Wonderful, wonderful teacher. Any of you read that book?
I've got it here.
It's excellent, isn't it? And it just goes through, you've got a year to live as you read the book. Mm-hmm. And it just makes you understand priority in a most simple way. Something in you just settles where you are. That's brilliant. Brilliant. That was such a compassionate thing he did, putting that book out. Because we all get pretty busy, don't we? Huh?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we put things off too. We don't do them.
But that's another way of being busy, isn't it? I mean, building up the guilt is always good. I am very good at building guilt for myself of all the emails I haven't answered. I can do more email guilt. I'm so glad they invented that, because I was sitting running ways of really being guilty. Now I'm acing it, you know. You know, a really good load of guilt could, like, really keep you hunkered in at the Nintendo, you know? We always have something that, it's being busy with guilt, being busy with fear, being busy with anger, being busy with whatever. Is it true that we do that? We think of busy as accomplishing or something. But anger is accomplishing, I'm not going to play. Isn't it? I already know what you're going to offer me, and I've got my wall built. Isn't that what anger does? You're not getting in. What does fear do? Feels a little bit like a wall too. I mean, it is a wall in a way, but it's a wall because the mind fixates.
Yeah.
Fixates on a point or two or three points, doesn't it? So those are all being busy, because you keep recreating the same deity and performing it over and over and saying the mantra. But you don't know you're doing it. You don't know you're doing it. And it's your life. It's my life. And I think that's where we need each other. Because who wants to do all those beginner's meditations? Oh. Precious, you and Bertha, yeah.
I gave us that one 5 years ago, Cecily.
And what was Cecily talking about? Oh, Precious, oh, yeah.
I'm glad
again. Yeah, I'm glad I didn't come. Been there, done that.
It's always new.
It is, yeah.
So that's why we keep becoming, because even if we get it,
we have to keep open, and the habit of grabbing is stronger than the trust of open. We have to practice the arising yoga of I'm glad I'm here, regardless of the circumstance. And the triggers to not do that are so automatic. And where there is a passion, there's a perception. And where there's a perception, there's a passion. So we have to develop the passion to see our passions. Mm-hmm. We have to move from the impure vision to what's called in Landre the vision of experience, where you have the experience to know that you are not the passion, and that the perception is not so interesting as perceiving how you can play with the passion. My perception of the outer world when I'm caught in a negative state is less interesting than my perceiving the negative state and seeing how I can play with it.
Right.
So that's called the vision of experience, where my vision is altogether involved with how I can make my experience the dance of liberation. Not the impure vision, when I feel this way, the world looks this way, when I feel this way, and I'm right. You know, they do all these things in physics. They have all these neat little tricks that they do, like, okay, there's these two warring countries, and they have decided that they'll sign a truce, but neither one of them wants to be the first one to sign. So they're sitting in a room, and they're gonna, right? You know this one? Huh? And there's somebody comes up with a bright idea. Okay, well, we'll put a light in the middle of the room, and one of them on each side, same distance away. And as soon as they see the light, they sign it. And they both sign it at the same time. It's all televised. So great, both sides agree. It's fantastic. And so this is really a great idea. So they carry this on. They do it a few more things across the Atlantic. And then one time there's two rulers, you know, the one who's I think they called it the president of forward and the president of backward or something.
On the train.
Yeah, and they're on a train, and they're traveling, and the light is in between. And for the people observing it in the train, it looked like they signed it at the same time. So everybody there is really happy. But for the people that were observing it from outside, because the train was traveling and the speed of light, one of them signed at 0.00000001 of a second. Before the other. Mm-hmm. So the war broke out again. And the understanding of the truth of that, that they're both right. That they are both right within this circumstance, with this cause and effect. This is what occurred. But from this angle, this is what occurred. Is a tenet of Buddhism. It has been a tenet of Buddhism for a long number of years. The vision of experience the impure vision is like sitting in an audience watching a magician perform a trick. The vision of experience is like standing at the side of the stage seeing how it's done. It's still magnificent, but you understand how it's done, so you don't quite believe it the same way, and you start wondering how you might change the way you react to it.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
So that is the path. That is the path to move yourself from the impure vision without negating the compassionate truth of the world, because you're more interested in the vision of experience.
Yes.
Not what your mother is or isn't doing, but what you can do when you react to her.
Yes.
What are your choices? Not only this right, but this right. That's called the vision of experience. And that is especially where we need Sangha. Because sometimes we're good at it and sometimes we're not. But when somebody else is good at it, we feel it. And it inspires us. It inspires us. And we have joy for them and for us because they did it. We're so happy. And wow, they helped us remember we can do it.
Yeah.
That's very nice. And you have to practice the vision of experience for a very long time. There are five stages of it, which is why I brought the book. You go, this is Lamdre, a text by Lama Chodek Rinpoche. Because I said that I would be talking about the healing power of awareness tonight. Is that right? First, what's relevant about Buddhism? First of all, I was going to talk about sadhana practice, which I talked about last night. So now the healing power of awareness is tonight. Is that right? Am I doing this right?
That's you.
Okay?
Yeah, you're doing okay, Seth.
B plus?
Oh, better than that.
It's hard to say where I'm going to start reading this.
Not at the beginning.
No. Certainly not. Okay, I'm just going to plunge in. When a person learns how to meditate, he or she will know how to apply appropriate antidotes to any distractions which arise. Like if your mind wanders, bring it back. Feel sleepy, sit up straighter. Open your eyes a little more. Don't eat right after. Don't eat and then go and sit. Don't drink 3 glasses of water and then 10 minutes later have to go to the bathroom. Like, there's little antidotes, right? The way she learns to apply these antidotes may be quite different from what she initially expected. The first time we use a tool, it always feels awkward. Not nice. It's not just a nice sentence. But as we become accustomed to it, we become more efficient and it seems easier to use. A meditator seems to improve his posture, manage his time better, and develop levels of discipline which most people lack. Somebody who's been doing it for a while, it's a lot easier. It's like riding a horse, you know. First time. After all. No problem. In making room For regular meditative experience, the meditator transforms his entire way of life. He develops a high degree of self-confidence. On the other hand, those who make a commitment to meditate but fail to fulfill it are left feeling dissatisfied with themselves. If a beginner misses one day or one week, it may take time for her to recapture her previous level. This is largely because of her unforgiving attitude toward missing a practice. Mm-hmm. Page 65. In print. Once we reach a mature level of realization, on the other hand, we'll understand there's nothing to be missed. Page 65 to 66. We will integrate our practice with everything we do. When we develop that degree of flexibility, there will be fewer hindrances to our vision of experience. Isn't that nice? All the time we spend in formal meditation will be beneficial. Whether it's scattered or sleepy, it's all beneficial. We will not waste time worrying about things which went amiss in the past. Each session will be a progression from the previous one, even if there have been gaps of time in between. Meditators encounter five levels of the vision of experience. The first thing most people notice when they begin any form of meditation is that they have too many thoughts. Some people become almost anti-thought as a reaction to this discovery. When the body is well relaxed and the mind begins to focus, this is the first overriding impression. The beginner will also regard the thoughts as things apart from herself. I'm meditating and those thoughts come. She wants to be something other than the thoughts. This stage is known as recognition of thoughts. The thoughts are always there, but most of the time we're not paying attention. We don't notice. So when you start to meditate, you think, I am thinking more than I ever did. It's a very valuable stage. It's not an evolved level of realization because the thoughts are seen as external. Mm-hmm. That's why it's not evolved. Because you think there's something you have to get rid of, or they're seen as external. Mm-hmm. That's why it's not evolved. But it is nevertheless a very important stage. It's a wonderful illustration of the impure vision. And believe me, we need that illustration. We need to remember that. Normally, we don't recognize that thoughts are us. We see them as separate things with their own inherent existence. It is then that most meditators begin struggling to bring their minds back to the object of meditation. They don't yet realize that the object is simply a reference point. Isn't this nice? Mm-hmm. The reference point has no value in itself other than its relationship with the distraction. Yes! Isn't that nice? Yes! Page 66. The reference point has no value in itself other than its relationship with distraction. Without the reference point, you wouldn't be able to see the distraction. Without the distraction, you wouldn't be able to see the reference. The mind will spend very little time on the object of meditation, no matter how much one values it. And more time on the distraction, which the beginner wants to reject. The meditator now faces the dilemma of what to make of the distraction. When meditators have sufficient experience and proper instruction, they will learn to see that thoughts are not external to them. But detailed instructions are not enough for us to achieve this realization. It takes a lot of practice before we get there. We will reach a stage where, although we may still see thoughts as external, we feel that we have dampened their impact. They don't seem to arise as often as before. When our concentration improves, the stream of thoughts contracts. A feeling of elation may arise. This is the second level, known as exhaust. You want to sit? Exhausting the thoughts. See, as the concentration deepens, the thoughts are a little more exhausted. The stream gets a little drier of thought. We still haven't realized that thoughts are part of us. We see them as separate entities which we are beginning to learn to control. Because thoughts rise infrequently now, we begin to wonder whether there were ever any thoughts outside of us. Mm-hmm. We start to realize the thoughts were part of us. Because you can see them better now, you know. See yourself better. Now there is an overhaul of the actual perceiver rather than the perceived. The meditator becomes more contemplative because she is starting to watch herself more than the thoughts. This realization totally extinguishes all thoughts, but only temporarily. This is the third stage, known as the annihilation of thoughts. We feel we have reached the point of transcending thoughts. And can now really start to make progress in meditation. Got on my meditation Harley Davidson and I'm ready to go. When she reaches that level, the meditator begins to experience elation. Consequently, she relaxes her effort. She considers she has come a long way and need not try so hard anymore. But this relaxation is premature. This sudden cessation of thoughts is really no time for relaxation. The thoughts are actually tricking us. Unfortunately, as soon as the meditator relaxes, another current of thoughts will arise as from nowhere. This sudden influx shakes the meditator, but as soon as he or she focuses on them, they disappear. If the meditator has developed some maturity, she will recognize that the thoughts have no substance. They are transient. They are all her mind. These thoughts tend to be very graphic, very emotional. They may move us to tears. At this stage, we are in many ways bending the thought pattern. Because of that, the current of thoughts tries to flow with our energy through our channels, but it is being stopped. This is what causes the high level of emotional activity. The fourth level is when we cannot accept that we are our thoughts, but neither are we any longer certain that our thoughts are external. You want me to read that again, or did you get it? The fourth level is when we cannot accept that we are our thoughts, but neither are we any longer certain that our thoughts are external. They appear to rise and fall. We seem to go through extremes. Sometimes we have no thoughts, other times we are inundated by them. It's like the waves of the ocean. This is called the experience of the ocean with waves. The mind wants to sustain a deep ocean-like level of concentration, but is unable to sustain its stillness or stop the waves. The meditator still regards the waves as avoidable. She can't tolerate them as part of the ocean. a sense of loneliness and sadness creeps in. It's very much a repetition of our everyday emotions that we normally don't deal with very well. Page 68. Certain emotions come that way just out of nowhere like waves. It's as if a very deep rooted pattern were trying to reveal itself on the surface of the mind. The way we tolerate this is very important. We have reached the point of seeing the mind as deep as the ocean, with the waves being the problem. Of course, waves are a special characteristic of a deep ocean. Being able to accept the waves will enable the meditator to remain in meditation. Until one accepts distraction as necessary, particularly at this level, one must feel that one is the distraction. As long as we persist in seeing distractions as external and unwanted, they will remain a constant problem. It is healthy to see them as our habitual self trying to stop functioning. Because it hasn't been stopped before, when we try to stop it for the first time, it will jerk, just as when we are driving a car and put the brakes on suddenly. Everything will be shaken up. The passengers will think they're still going forward. At this stage, the impure vision is still current, but it is trying to be transformed by the vision of experience. When we awaken from a nightmare, we are left with the residue of the dream, even though we know nothing really happened. We are now approaching the fifth stage of meditation, where the meditator no longer notices the difference between the ocean and the waves. The ocean doesn't notice its own waves. It's the people who want the ocean to be calm who notice the waves. When we don't think of things as fundamental problems, they don't manifest as problems at all. This is where the meditator recognizes the distractions and the thoughts as himself. Therefore, she is not interrupting the thoughts as they arise. Instead, she is recognizing herself. She is preventing the continuation of the old habitual self in the meditation. Now the old habitual self and the yogic person doing the meditation have become two quite different characters. The meditator cannot help but remember the past, so she is wearing two sets of shoes at the same time. She is in the body of the old self with many of its experiences, but with the sessional experience of a yogi. It's like a person being possessed by a spirit from New Guinea and speaking a New Guinea tongue. It takes a while to remove the spirit. When a medium returns to consciousness, it takes a while for him to reestablish his old territory. Similarly, meditation is a deep trance level transformation of consciousness. If one hasn't entered into one of the four levels of jhana, the old self would still be lurking. If so, it will interfere with the smooth development of the five stages. The five experiences do not necessarily develop in one session sequentially, to say the least. We might find that sometimes we are in the middle of the third experience without having gone through the first and second. If we have years of meditation practice, we may never come across the first, second, and third. We might always be at the fourth and fifth. Some people may be reaching the fourth and fifth level, but still get stuck in the first sometimes. That doesn't mean that they've relapsed. It is the conditioning of the ordinary mind by the ordinary perception which hinders it. It is the conditioning of the ordinary mind by the ordinary perception which hinders it from entering into the meditative mood. The fifth level is the one which brings about the ninth level of calm abiding meditation, which produces insight, vipassana. Mm-hmm. At this level, the mind lacks anything that is relatable to the self. Mm-hmm. There is consciousness without subject-object duality, like when you're totally bliss. There is no object that can take the mind away from us. Mm-hmm. Objects have lost their magnetic quality. Mm-hmm. We can now focus our mind where we want it to be. The self is empty. There is almost a sense of realizing no self. We can now remain in a trance state and enter the four levels of trance. That's jhana. Using the word trance means jhana. At this stage, if we have not developed the Mahayanist attitude and we use the vision of experience for our own liberation, our attainment will be very limited. This is the trap of cessation of self. The Mahayanist approach avoids falling into this trap through the altruistic intention to liberate all sentient beings. This altruism reminds us to extend beyond our own realization of the insight. Our concern is about how best to exemplify this and pass the benefit to others. This is a Lamdre book. It's a book that Lama Chodek Rinpoche, Chodak, last name Yutashok, Chodak, his first name, last name Yutashok. The book is Lamdre, Dawn of Enlightenment, and this is a series of lectures on the Lamdre teachings of the Shakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism that were given as an introductory course before one takes the Lamdre teaching, which is the highest yoga tantra of the Shakya tradition. And so this is suitable for anyone. It's not just for people who have taken the Lamdre. This is, anybody can get this. Published and distributed by Gorum Publications, G-O-R-U-M Publications, P.O. Box 3430, Manuka, M-A-N-U-K-A, capital A, capital C, capital T, 2603, Australia. So that's what I wanted to talk about tonight and read.
Thank you.
Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Yes?
Earlier you talked about the emotional body.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talk about the speech body.
Same body.
Why is it called the speech body?
Because it communicates. Mm.
Okay.
It impresses. It informs. It's the shaper, the sculptor. All that. The winds.
So it's not mine.
It is. If one were going to classify only as nama and rupa, it would be nama. But it's nama leading into the hyphen. Or maybe nama and the hyphen leading into rupa. Nama means mind and rupa means form. So one of the ways of defining any manifestation is by calling it nama-rupa, mind-body, mind-form, mm-hmm. consciousness-form. You have another question?
No.
Okay. Anyone else? You're adequately sufficed then? Okay. Notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts.
don't close your eyes.
Spreads through your body, up your spine, down your legs, down your arms, goes through your shoulders, down your arm, by your hands, by your feet, up your neck, out your ears, top of your head, out your eyes, out the back of your head, fills this room, fills this whole house. Fills Ottawa, goes up in the air, into the ground. This glowing globe of gold light just smooths right through all of North America. The whole world, wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, and mind. Anyone you want to pray for, just imagine them washed by this light. Any circumstance, whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. So thank you. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.